WHYY is proudly supported by Penn Medicine. From groundbreaking discoveries to life-saving care, Penn Medicine's innovation is helping to change lives, one moment, one treatment, one patient at a time.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. As the son of an African father from the Congo and an African-American mother, Philip Wamba is well aware of the myths that Africans and African-Americans hold about each other. His new book, Kinship, explores those myths and the culture and politics that unite and divide the two groups. Wamba was born in 1971 and spent the first 8 years of his life in the U.S., mostly in suburban Boston, while his father completed his advanced studies and taught. The family moved to Tanzania when Philippe was 8. He returned to the U.S. to study at Harvard and Columbia. Throughout his life, his father, Ernest Wamba Dia Wamba, has been an opponent of the corrupt governments in his native country Congo, formerly Zaire. But a year ago, he crossed the line from intellectual dissident to rebel leader of a group trying to overthrow President Kabila. 2 weeks ago, he signed a peace agreement. If it holds, it will end the fighting in Congo that started last year. Philippe's parents met in 1965 when they were both students at Western Michigan University. Their decision to get married was met with some concern on his mother's side. For example, her parents worried that their daughter's African fiancé could be a polygamist.
This is one of the very, very common ideas about Africans that persist among African Americans. And of course, it has its basis in reality where, you know, in that polygamy is indeed practiced among a number of African ethnic groups. So one of the early questions that parts of my mom's family had was, well, are you going to be the third or fourth wife? Are you going to be his only wife? And then there was another stereotype about African men being wife beaters. And would he be battering her? So there was these concerns about how she was going to be treated. There were concerns about would she be moving away from the United States, moving to Africa, where they didn't know very much about the continent or what to expect, and how would she cope over there? Do they have modern technology, modern amenities? So there was a lot of consternation on those, on all of those levels. But I think that ultimately, you know, having met my father and spent some time with him and been impressed with him as an individual, impressed with his intelligence, with his commitment. He was very academically inclined and spoke often about how he wanted to return to his homeland and make some kind of a contribution in independent Congo. So I think that because of the personal example of that he brought, as far as when they met him, they were impressed enough to allay some of their fears about what my mother would encounter when she went to Africa.
You describe your mother as someone who had been a black nationalist and who was very, very interested in Africa even before you met your father. When you were growing up in the United States, growing up in a suburb of Boston, what impressions did you have of Africa from hearing your father talk about it and your mother who had lived there briefly in the Congo before you were born?
My father would tell us these stories, my brothers and I, stories about his upbringing in the rural village in western Congo where he grew up. And these were very nostalgic, fond, affectionate stories in which he talked about the stories that his mother would tell them around the communal fire in the evening, about tending the farms that his family, where they raised the crops that they subsisted on. So these, you can imagine, sounded completely removed and distant from my suburban experience in West Newton, Massachusetts. So using these ingredients, I, you know, sort of cobbled together my own conception of what Africa was all about and had this very strong sense of identification, sense of pride, sense of wanting to visit and wanting very much to move there, and had the opportunity when I was 8 years old and my family moved to Tanzania.
And they moved to Tanzania. Your father had accepted a teaching position at a university in Dar es Salaam.
Yes.
Your father is a scholar of history. So you moved there when you were 8, and suddenly all the fantasies that you had were supplanted by the reality of being in Tanzania. How did the reality of your new neighborhood and your new kind of family life compare with the fantasies you had in your mind?
Well, the fantasies that I had were basically that, fantasies. They were the stories that were, you know, passed down to me, just sparked my imagination and sent it in all sorts of new directions. And then arriving in Tanzania, there wasn't that much that was familiar, even from the stories that had been told. But still, I found this place that just tantalized me in all sorts of ways, in terms of my imagination, in terms of new experiences. I guess, you know, it's important to remember that I was 8 years old at the time, and that it was just an experience experimentation and just learning the language, learning new foods, learning the new landscape, new games, learning, making new friends. So it was an amazing experience of discovery. And I guess I had been prepared to have such a positive experience of it by the positive expectation that had been created by my parents, who had passed on such affectionate, fond, and proud images of their experience of Africa. So it was a true homecoming.
Now, you had spent the first 8 years of your life mostly in a suburb of Boston, a predominantly white suburb of Boston. What was it like in terms of, like, your identity to go from being, a black person in a predominantly white suburb of Boston to moving to, you know, Dar es Salaam, where, you know, it's a black African population? Did you have a different sense of what it meant to be black?
Well, yes. I mean, I can remember arriving in Dar es Salaam at the airport and being very strongly impressed by the fact that everywhere I looked were black people. Dar es Salaam also has a large Asian community, Asian as in from India, and has a large sort of Afro-Arab community. So all of these, you know, various shades of brown, basically, were what impressed me when I first set foot on Tanzanian soil. But what sort of I came to understand was that the complexity of ethnicity in Africa, which has a more multifaceted aspect to it than in the United States, where things are often in binary black and white or various shades in between, but much more stratified than in Tanzania, because I found that while I had been a minority in a suburb of Boston as a black person, I was still a minority in Dar es Salaam, in that I was a foreigner. I was black, yes, but I was not a Tanzanian. I was not a member of any of the tribes that my playmates belonged to. So all of these things, it gave me a sort of much more complex appreciation of what identity meant in different contexts.
When you were a boy, the government of Zaire, which is now Congo, was pressuring your father to return to the country because they thought that he was trying to overthrow President Mobutu, and they wanted to be able to keep an eye on him. He didn't want to go, so he instead was living in Tanzania with the family where he was teaching. But his father was dying in 1980, and he wanted to see him, so he made a brief trip back to Zaire. And then the following year, in 1981, he went back, and the rest of the family, you, your brother, your mother, was supposed to meet him later at the airport. You showed up at the airport. You were still under 10 years old. And what happened?
Well, it was an especially traumatic experience in that it was supposed to be my family's first homecoming to the country of my father. It was my first time stepping on Congolese, then Zairean soil. And we were met at the airport by soldiers who informed us that my father had been detained for the possession of so-called subversive documents, which were critical of the regime then in power in Zaire. So it was quite a challenging encounter. My mother, then with three very young children, myself, I was 10 years old. My younger brothers were 7 and 3, respectively, I believe. And this was our first time visiting Kinshasa. My father's family has a number of family members in the city, but when we were met at the airport by these soldiers, we had no way of contacting them. We spent some days in the city trying to get in touch with my father's family, trying to get to see him in the prison where he was being held. It was a rather nightmarish experience, and I think had a big impact on myself and the rest of my family.
How did your mother explain to you that your father was considered a subversive by the government of the country he grew up in? I mean, how do you explain that to a 10-year-old?
Well, it wasn't as though I had never heard of Mobutu Sese Seko, who was then the president for life of Zaire.
Your father had already told you he was a bad guy.
Yes, basically. So I was aware that there was this this regime in power and that my father was hostile to it for his own principled political reasons, and that it, I guess, that it was also averse to him, but it was still something of a shock that he had been detained. He was an academic, a professor. It was difficult for me as a child to understand that just for writing an essay, which pointed out that he disagreed with certain government policies, that his life would be jeopardized for that act.
It took about a year of pressure, you know, not only from your family, but international pressure, before your father was released by Mobutu's regime. When your father was released, after being in prison and being tortured on and off for a year, was he a changed man? Did you sense any difference in him?
If anything, he was probably more committed to his goals and political beliefs. I think he had, as I said, been a patriot, had been deeply disturbed by the course that the country had taken under Mobutu. I think that after his experience in detention, he redoubled his efforts to try and work for change in Congo. Again, however, through the same channels that he had before, which was as an academic, as a concerned intellectual, writing essays which were critical, attending conferences. He would had contact with other dissidents who were critical of the government. And over the years, he basically generated quite a impressive collection of work that relates to the political history of the Congo and the nature of oppression in Congo, and proposed some solutions, which is basically the work that led to his current activities. He's referring to quite an impressive collection of references.
When your father was in jail for mm-hmm. the better part of a year, where were you and your family?
In Dar es Salaam. Well, mainly in Dar es Salaam, but partly my mother made a couple of trips to the United States trying to continue the campaign to gain his release. She made a couple of trips to Kinshasa to visit him while he was in detention and also continue the campaign. But my brothers and I were, for the most part, in Dar es Salaam.
My guest is Philippe Wamba, author of the new book Kinship. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest, Philippe Wamba, is the author of Kinship, A Family's Journey in Africa and America. His mother is African-American. His father is from Congo. Philippe grew up in the U.S. and Africa. Well, your father is now the head of a rebel faction that is trying to overthrow the government of Mobutu's successor, the government of Laurent Kabila. Your father's the head of the Rally for Democracy in the Congo, the RCD. He's been calling for a negotiated settlement, and a peace agreement was signed about a week ago. Hopefully it will hold. You say you found out about this from a news report. You didn't know that your father was leading this rebel group. What was it like to... Tell me about that experience.
It was a little bit of a shock, but...
This was about a year ago?
It was August of 1998 when the rebellion started. The mm-hmm. rebellion started on August 2nd. And I read about it, I think, a couple of weeks after, maybe. I think the movement was formally announced on August 12th or so. It was a bit of a shock, but it wasn't that surprising, if you understand what I mean. And what I mean by that is that over the years, my father has always been engaged, has remained very deeply involved in political movements for change in Congo. And he had already expressed great reservations to me about the regime that had taken over in Congo in 1997, when Mobutu was overthrown. There had been a great deal of optimism among Congolese and among Africans all over the world when Mobutu, this is like one of the last Cold War dictators who had ruled for 32 years, oppressive rule, kleptocratic rule, had, you know, pillaged the country of more than $5 billion, was finally overthrown in April of 1997. And there was this great optimism that this would actually mean that there was finally going to be some substantive change for the Congolese people. When less than a year after Kabila took power, this hoped-for change did not really come to pass. Many, including my father, were very disappointed. And when the Kabila government sort of started taking steps that were even more alarming, initially it was, you know, the same sort of corruption, the same sort of a rule of one single ethnic group, the same sort of patronage and clientelism. And then when this sort of started leaning towards basically another genocide to follow the one that took place in Rwanda in 1994, for many, including my father, that was the most alarming step. And that was when this rebellion broke out in August 1998.
You have always known your father as a scholar, a university professor. Now he's a rebel leader. I mean, instead of just having the pen, he has the sword, so to speak. He probably had to learn how to shoot a gun.
Yes, he over the past year, he's learned a number of things, that being one of them. But the thing is, and something that was sort of has been argued back and forth when he first became involved, there's been this ongoing question. I'm sure it's been a question for many others, not just my father, historically. An academic or an intellectual who sees themselves as involved in a tradition of activism, presents itself this question of what is the limits of that commitment? Does one just theorize about politics and political change, or does one actually at some point take the step towards actually getting involved? There was an academic from Guyana named Walter Rodney who had taught at the University of Dar es Salaam shortly before my family moved there. And he had this famous phrase saying that it's not enough to merely study history. Ultimately, an academic has to get his feet wet. The point being that the ultimate and sort of logical conclusion to a tradition of scholarship and activism geared towards fundamental change was that ultimately you would be led into the struggle in a very active way. And that, I guess, is the path that my father has taken.
You're a historian yourself. I mean, that, well, history was your major. There's a lot of history in your new book. And I'm wondering if this is a bit of a call to arms for you as well, if it's making you rethink what your role should be as somebody who's steeped in history.
It has forced me to question, to figure out exactly what my role will be. And I can't really say, I guess, in concrete terms at this particular moment, but I have this same sense of optimism that my father has, and I do feel like we are poised on the cusp of some significant change in Congo, and it's something I would definitely like to be a part of. I don't know if I would really call it patriotism that I feel for Congo, since I've only spent in total maybe a month in the country for political reasons, for reasons of circumstance, for reasons of where I grew up and where it was necessary for my family to live throughout the years of my childhood. I do feel at home in Tanzania. I have been to Congo on a number of occasions and have very close family ties there. I do see myself living in Africa at some point in the near future, and I do see myself weighing in whatever way I can on basically on the side of African freedom, on the side of African democracy. I don't necessarily see myself taking an active role in politics, but I would like to make whatever contribution that I can, whether it's in terms of writing books like the one I just did, and which I hope will help to build some bridges as far as Pan-Africanism and as far as relations between Africans and African-Americans go, and as far as providing some of the historical knowledge that I feel is underemphasized. I was trying in my book to unearth some of the things that fascinated me that I thought were little known to black people and to whoever else is, these ideas resonate among. And hopefully I'm beginning, I've achieved that, but hopefully I'll be able to do more of that in the future. But
it sounds like you're still a little shy about being in the role of being a public speaker.
Yeah, I think so.
And I think the book is going to thrust you more in that position. And it's interesting that as you're being put in more of that position, you're watching your father be put in a very public position.
Well, I mean, I feel like I still have time. If he's in his mid-50s and now in that position, and I'm 28 and just wrote my first book and still, I think, finding myself professionally and otherwise. So all in good time.
Absolutely.
But I do feel like, as far as the book writing, I feel like I've learned a lot and learned the skills and tools that I can apply to another such project in the future or could go in any number of directions.
Philippe Wamba is the author of Kinship, A Family's Journey in Africa and America. We'll talk some more in the second half of the show. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with Philippe Wamba. His new book, Kinship, is about the culture and politics that unite and divide Africans and African Americans. Wamba is the son of an African father and an African American mother. He spent the first 8 years of his life in the U.S., then lived in Tanzania until returning to the U.S. to attend college. When you went to college at Harvard, it was during a period when there was a lot of Afrocentrism in a lot of college campuses. Tell me a little bit about what it was like to be exposed to Afrocentrism in America after coming from Africa.
Well, the main thing that I sort of realized about Afrocentrism when I encountered it in America was that the Africa that was being celebrated by African-American Afrocentrists, it bore very little resemblance to the Africa that I had grown up in.
What were some of the differences between the Afrocentrism, the kind of Africanism Afrocentrism celebrated, and what you grew up with?
Well, one of the hallmarks of Afrocentrism is this emphasis on ancient Egypt and ancient Nubia. To my knowledge, or from growing up in Tanzania and East Africa, we didn't really have much sense of, I mean, those were things that were ground in ancient history and did not really have many sort of contemporary manifestations. However, among African Americans, some African American Afrocentrists would greet each other with greetings that were supposed to be ancient Egyptian, would dress in ways that were supposed to be inspired by ancient Egyptians. However, it seemed to me to be more of a celebration of that ancient past. But the outcome of that was that it not prevented, but allowed them to avoid confronting the contemporary reality of Africa, which to me was something that I found frustrating, because sometimes I would meet people who would express an interest in Africa, but after a few exchanges, did not seem to know very much about contemporary politics, about contemporary languages, culture, but did seem to have this very in-depth knowledge of some ancient traditions. So that was something that I found difficult to come to terms with at some points.
Now, you say in the book that although a lot of the students that you met had this kind of romantic notion about what Africa was and what it represented, that sometimes when faced with somebody who actually came from Africa, the African would be perceived as, quote, too white. And I'm wondering what accounts for that? What accounted for that?
I think there's a number of different things, but one of it is this sense of unfamiliarity, and that in America, things are often race relations and social groups are often reduced to this sort of binary divide between black and white. And from some African Americans that I had encountered, my sense was that if you didn't conform to a certain set of African American standards, some stereotypes perhaps about what was expected of you as an African American, then you could be dismissed as too white. In America, race and the divide between black and white is sometimes all-consuming, especially for black students. In Africa, where that's less so, where some of the divisions might be more religious in nature, more tribal in nature, more ethnic in nature, geographical, class, if those are sort of the cleavages that people are more aware of or have more of a role in shaping people's viewpoint and in terms of situating themselves in the world, when they come to the United States without that sense of racial divide, it means that they relate to the world and to each other and to other black people in a different way. And that sometimes, I think, is part of the source of this alienation, discomfort, unfamiliarity.
Another set of differences that you found in terms of the way Africans see African-Americans and how African-Americans see Africans. In Africa, you found that a lot of people there felt like, why aren't African-Americans more interested in Africa? Why aren't they doing more to support African causes? Why aren't they better read about African issues? And in America, you found a lot of African-Americans felt, why don't Africans care more about what happened to African descendants after they were captured and taken into slavery and shipped off to the United States? Do you think that those are still kind of rifts between the two cultures?
Yeah, I think they are. And the big issue there in both of those cases, both of those perspectives are informed by a strong sense of expectation. And the expectation is based on this appreciation of kinship. On the African side, you have, Africans who have these myths of African-American richness or wealth and wonder why, if African-Americans are all wealthy, why they wouldn't come to Africa and help to uplift their African cousins.
And these images of wealth are because they see so many celebrities. They see, celebrity hip-hoppers and celebrity actors and used to watch the Bill Cosby show, and that's what gives that sense of
wealth. Yeah, and then on the other side, you have African-Americans who there was a comedian, Eddie Griffin, who I think he has a television show, but on one of his stand-up routines, he had this, he was talking about why it was that Africans hadn't attempted to rescue African-Americans from slavery. And there is this popular perception that slavery was somehow a product of Africans selling off their undesired kin. And that's the source of some quite deep resentment that I've noted, regardless of how historically accurate that idea might be. Again, there's this expectation that if we are indeed kin, then why is it that we ended up in America? Why is it that you Africans don't seem to care about what has happened to us or aren't really involved with confronting some of the issues that we have to confront as black people in America? And it carries over into the dynamic of the relationship between Africans who live in the United States and African Americans. African communities in this country, immigrant communities, have been growing for a number of years. But for the most part, these communities remain fairly insular and often have slightly antagonistic relationships with African American communities.
Do you hope to play a part in helping to translate African and African-American life to people living in the United States and in Africa?
It's something throughout my life, growing up first in the United States and then moving to Africa, especially when I was living in Africa, I would often, my brothers and I would form this role as cultural mediators between African-Americans and Africans. Sometimes that was just a simple issue of translating from Swahili to English for an African-American traveler who was visiting Africa. And then even on this side of the ocean, Afro-Tanzanians who have come over here, sometimes people I've known, sometimes people I haven't, just acting as a sort of cultural guide in terms of getting them oriented. And so I have somehow felt myself sort of uniquely situated to be able to mediate across the divide and then hopefully to build bridges across that divide. And that's something I would definitely hope to be involved in the future.
Well, Philippe Wamba, I want to thank you very much. Thank you for talking with us.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
Philippe Wamba is the author of Kinship, A Family's Journey in Africa and America. He's currently living in Cambridge and working for a website of African news. This is Fresh Air.